When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So everything was going well, so you decided you needed to do a story about the Christ.
Yeah.
Because now, was that a calling, would you say, or was that another challenge?
It was just something that got into my head about the. I just kept having visions about it, you know, and about, you know, what was that like 12 hours like? What was that really like? I mean, what does it mean to get scourged and crucified and the significance of what one single event and what one God-man has done historically and changed civilization. I mean, this is like an amazing thing. I mean, and of course, you know, you step into that arena, whew, you know, it's going to create some fireworks.
Hello and welcome to the latest film club. It's The Passion of the Christ, directed by Mel Gibson, who you heard at the top there. I was going to intro with a trailer, but since the dialogue is in Aramaic and Latin, I didn't see the point. So you get Mel there talking about why he made the film and the reaction to it. Anyway, without further ado, please do share the pod with the like-minded, and I'll hand you over to me and director Tim Hewitt on The Passion of the Christ. Okay, Tim, welcome back to this month's film club, and
thank you so much.
And this is us charging in, blundering into a controversial topic right in the middle of problems in the Middle East. Why not just like a bull in a china shop? We are going to cover Passion of the Christ, directed by Mel Gibson. So not only is this probably a controversial choice because it's, you know, well, I don't know why the subject matter is not necessarily controversial, given that Christianity is a
I don't think
the biggest religion in the world, isn't it?
But I don't think a subject matter on its own should be a controversy.
No. But we may mention a few things today that given what's going on anyway.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Mel Gibson. This is the first Gibson film we've had on the pod, although he did star in a film that we have covered, The Bounty.
He's actually two, and Gallipoli as well.
Oh, yes, of course, Gallipoli. Forgot about that, yeah.
So it may look like that you and I have a slight Mel Gibson obsession, but I don't think that's entirely true.
I think we both like Mel Gibson.
Yeah, as an artist, it's, you know, can separate the man from the artist, then
yes, let's just clear that up.
Yes,
Mel Gibson exactly. Has been accused, was arrested and for drunk driving, and this was about 10 or 15 years ago, and the Aspects of History lawyers have confirmed that this did happen, so we can mention it. Mm-hmm. And he started going off on one about the Jews running the world.
Yeah, and being responsible for all the wars in the world.
Yeah. Classic anti-Semitic trope that rightly condemned for. Did do the old, well, you know, I was struggling with alcoholism at the time and all that kind of stuff. But added to the fact that The Passion of the Christ got criticized for anti-Semitism, that therefore does make Gibson a little bit of a controversial filmmaker.
Yeah, and it sort of started after... it didn't really, like, his early career, his acting career, you know, from his Aussie films to Lethal Weapon, even into like Hamlet, when he played Hamlet rather well, I thought, actually, the Franco Zeffirelli film with a great cast, up until, you know, the early 90s. Then he did his first film as a director called The Man Without a Face, which is actually quite a nice film. It's quite a good film. It's quite nice and quite a little bit moving and just simple sort of directorial debut. And then, you know, he pulls Braveheart out of the bag in his second film as a director in his late 30s, in which he starred, produced, directed. You know, everything was fine, it seemed, I think, as far as I can tell.
You mean fine in his
personal life? Yeah, I mean, there was, you know, nothing kind of shone through in his career until I think The Passion of the Christ, I think.
Now, did he choose to make this because he was very religious, or did he find religion after having made this?
I think he's always been super. His dad, I think there was a known fact that his dad is an extremely religious person, and that I think there was a little bit of controversy maybe surrounding that. Don't quote me on this, but he I think was raised religiously and moved from the States when he was nine to Australia, went to drama school in Australia. But I think he's always been religious. So I think this was an extremely personal film for him. And it was something that I think had been brewing for a while. He originally wanted to do it with no subtitles because he just wanted the story to tell itself visually. And I think one can argue it sort of succeeded, even with subtitles. But no, I don't think this is his, you know, it was very, very personal to him.
And just to add to you mentioning him being raised, he's been raised Catholic.
Yes. To be sure. One of nine children, I think nine. Again, don't quote me on that. We should look at the facts first, I suppose. He is the sixth of 11 children.
Okay. So definitely Catholic. Right. Well, okay. So this was obviously a passion project, excuse the pun. And this is, okay. So I've watched it a couple of times before having seen it, I think, when it first came out.
Yeah, I saw it in the cinema. I actually saw it in the cinema a couple of times. Yeah, it was that was quite an experience.
Well, I found it a very difficult watch, unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
It's one of the most harrowing films I've ever seen.
Which I guess was the point, you know.
It's not Life of Brian.
this is not Life of Brian. This is not even the Last Temptation of Christ, which is Scorsese's film, or even some of the other films like Pasolini's the Gospel According to St. Matthew, which was a kind of a revered film. I mean, how many films have been made about Jesus
in Montreal?
Quite a lot. But I think this is probably, you know, in terms of, if this is what we're going to get onto in terms of, I guess, that covers the controversy of it, and also, you know, what was true and what was not true, of course, being a history podcast. But I think, you know, this is the most I want to put in inverted commas, literal storytelling of the events that happened simply one after the other. This is what happened from the Garden of Gethsemane up to the crucifixion, and then, you know, well, this little epilogue that he put on at the end in the tomb. But it's pretty much just the sequence one after another as it happened.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's very difficult.
As he thinks it happens.
It's very difficult to make a film that's historically accurate based on you know, the New Testament, the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, John. But
it's an interesting point that I'd like to ask you, actually, and any historian who's listening. Am I right in thinking that historians pretty much agree that there was a man who likely did these rather new, what would be called new benevolent acts of preaching, you know, essentially be nice to each other as opposed to be a bunch of bastards to each other.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's pretty much accepted that Jesus existed.
Mm. Or Joshua, I suppose he would be technically Tacitus, known as.
Just to give an example of a source, Tacitus mentions Tacitus is a major historian of the Roman period. So, yeah, there's no doubt about it, you know. And, you know, again, Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea period. So some of us might have gone through a period in our early 20s when one questions one's upbringing, like I did, thinking it was all a load of rubbish. But no, that's not true at all. It is clearly significant. There is clearly a historical basis for the Gospels.
And we see this kind of figure, you know, crop up through human history, you know, a benevolent type, usually from humble beginnings, You know, you rarely get extremely rich politicians who talk about from the heart, genuinely turn the other cheek. You know, I mean, they do in a way, but it's all very cryptic and terrible. But it's all, you know, you see these Martin Luther King, maybe Gandhi, you know, even I want to say even John Lennon, you know, just these. So I know it's a terrible
John Lennon.
Maybe it's a comparison. Well, you know, the fighting for peace, the fighting to be benevolent, not, you know, that was just one example. I mean, there are loads, obviously, but and I guess, you know, one could argue that Jesus maybe was the.
John Lennon, I don't think did come from humble beginnings either.
I don't. Well, he didn't come from a wealth of money, did he?
I think quite a comfortable middle class.
And by the way, I'm not saying this isn't. Please, no.
Yeah,
no,
I've latched
on to
the John
money.
Lennon thing. I'm not.
It was 2,000 years ago. This was probably an extremely new way of thinking.
Yes. Yeah. Life was harsh 2,000 years ago.
And very vengeful, and everything was to do with, you know.
Yeah, Jesus was the sort of woke. joke
version, yeah,
woke,
yeah. And it said something about the type of person that does this, you know, from not well to do. It's all to do with, you know, it's a selfless way of thinking. And so in that period, it must have been something quite astonishing to hear. And
well, yes, in the film, they do the Sermon on the Mount as a flashback where he talks about you must love your enemy.
Yes, because yeah. Yeah.
Where's the reward in just loving people who love you?
Mm.
So, yeah.
And that must have been a frightening thing to hear, the officials to hear. You know, who the heck is this guy saying this blasphemy, I suppose, particularly when they thought that the Messiah was going to be, you know, someone on a flame or a chariot or, you know, bathed in light and not some carpenter's son who wore sandals. Well, they all probably wore sandals, but you know what I mean? It must have been, who the heck does he think he is? All the more amazing for it, because this is a figure who was, you know, you would really rarely find anyone like that, even today. I mean, that selfless and that forward thinking and that humble.
Yeah. So, that's why became the foundation of the largest.
And it really worked, because we had so much fun to look forward to, like hanging, drawing and quartering.
Yes, all in the name of the good Lord. Yes. Right. So let's just talk about, let's sort of try and get back to the film without your kind of evangelical ramblings. 30
Actually,
minutes.
It's rooted in reality, but anyway, carry on.
Yeah, well, let's take it back to the rather dreary subject of money. It cost 30 million to make, which actually was not as much as I thought it would be. And
no, but he
made
did
over 600 million in the box office.
Yeah, and he did put a lot of money in himself. Well, I suppose it was difficult to find financiers for this sort of thing. And I believe it became the most profitable or highest grossing R-rated film ever. Not only that, but highest grossing foreign language film at that point. I think maybe it's been surpassed. I don't know.
Well, you know, this speaks to, you know, we talked about this with the Napoleon film. In that this film did brilliant. I mean, of course, you know, it helps because you're dealing with a subject that is has a willing, a very enthusiastic audience ready to go, really, subject matter.
Yeah.
But this is a film in Latin and Hebrew.
Mm-hmm. And Aramaic, yeah.
Yeah. So these are not languages that are commonly spoken.
No, so it was remarkable.
Yeah, whilst they are the basis for many modern languages. But the fact that you can make an entire film with no English spoken at all, and then it's so successful, it makes you want to sort of grab Hollywood and go, you can do this, just, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I do put it down to the fact that it did extremely well in the cinemas, because also there had been so much controversy, not only the controversy about the subject matter and the fact that I think the Vatican, all these, you know, religious groups were like, boycott the film before they had even seen the film, which has happened a lot. That happened before The Last Temptation of Christ came out. But also the fact that it had been so cloaked in this concept that it was so horrific to watch that people just flocked to the cinemas because they were like, I've heard this is so violent and horrible. I'm going to go check it out about Jesus, you know?
I think that's probably why I wanted to go and watch it, actually.
Well, I wanted to go see it because, yes, I'd read a lot about it, but I was very interested in the, how he was going to show the subject matter. But not only that, I was a big fan of him as a director, having seen, obviously seen Braveheart, and that had won Best Picture, Best Director, swept the awards in most, not only the Academy Awards, but...
Was this his third film?
Yeah, so this is his third film as director. So I kind of, I knew, I really wanted to, I was a fan of his work as a director. He'd only made two films, but I thought, you know, he's going to be a regular director now. And I'm just curious, I'm interested in see what, you know, and then he followed this with Apocalypto, which was, you know, adrenaline pumping, brilliantly directed action film. Again, a slightly controversial subject matter, but.
Yeah, it was brilliant, Apocalypto.
I mean, yeah, it was just.
Quentin Tarantino has named this as one of the best films of the 2000s, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And I it was, you know, he's I guess, you know, having learnt from people like George Miller, having worked with him on the Mad Max films, who's an amazing action director, of course, and all the other Lethal Weapon, Richard Donner, you know, he's worked with so many times, and like a sponge soaked up all
Peter
his,
Weir, of course.
And Peter Weir, of course. Amazing. So you could kind of see why he's now an aficionado in that genre. Well, not only action, but like we're going to, I guess, talk about in this film, you know, it's pretty emotional.
Yeah, so there's a 10-year break between Apocalypto and Hacksaw Ridge. Is that partly down to the fact that he's persona non grata in Hollywood?
Yeah, I think he kind of went a bit quiet for a while. Maybe rightly so. It wasn't a particularly brilliant time.
Well, he's now making, and this will be interesting, but he is making a sequel.
To The Passion of the Christ.
Yes, Passion of the Christ Resurrection.
I've seen a couple of interviews with him about what it could possibly entail. And he does talk about, you know, other realms.
Right.
Like Jesus, you know, I think after he died, he went to hell to save the damned. You know, what that's going to look like, that'll be interesting. He doesn't really delve too much into the sort of the other realms in this. Yeah,
I think that's what makes it good. But because, you know, that's going to be his own interpretation, which will inevitably come up against other people's interpretations who won't like it. So we should talk about the cast.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, and the man who's going to appear in the sequel, prizing his role as Jesus Christ, which is Jim Caviezel. Jim Caviezel's had a weird career as well. I first saw him in the Thin Red Line, Terrence Malick film.
Yes, excellent film.
But he's got these sort of high cheekbones. He's a very good-looking man.
He has done some rather low-par films.
Yes, he's done some shockers, let's face it. Mm. And he is a little bit of... There's a tinge of B-movie about him, isn't there?
Yes, that's true. He jumped at this, I think, because he is very religious.
So he's done something controversial recently as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's about Robert De Niro.
Oh, what was that?
Oh, he said in an interview that he would never work with Robert De Niro because he's ungodly.
Really?
That's mixing the professional with the personal. Yes, so he's rather well cast in this film.
Yeah, he is. We should also mention that Jim Caviezel made a film called Sound of Freedom, which involves child sex trafficking. It is linked to the QAnon conspiracy, which I think he's a proponent of, or at least a proponent of elements of, allegedly, the lawyers have asked me to mention. Yeah, and so he's an interesting, so maybe him and Mel, you know, they get on.
They get on. I mean, whether Gibson is also a believer in the QAnon movement, who knows? I don't think it's ever been mentioned, but maybe it has. The thing is it's very difficult to have an opinion about people without sounding like, you know, we know everything and it's obvious that this is the case and it's obvious that whatever. I mean, to be honest, at the end of the day, I will put my hands up and say, I don't really care.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like Tom Cruise and Scientology.
I was going to mention Scientology, actually, because I was thinking about this. If they all want to believe, you know, that spacemen came down and made the planet, good luck to them.
Yeah, and as long as it doesn't, you know, intrude on one's personal life or you know, I was going to say offend people. I mean, it's like, well, you can believe what you want. But we're talking about the art and
yes. So Jim Caviezel, other than so he did a weird film called Frequency.
Yes, saw that film. Actually, it wasn't that bad.
Okay, but it wasn't that great either. he was very good in The Count of Monte Cristo. And having read The Count of Monte Cristo, I thought that was a pretty decent adaptation for a close to 800-page book.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a good. It is very good. But other than that, he's not really lived up to his early promise. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, this is probably his most famous, for those people who know him, his most famous performance.
So elsewhere in the film, we've got okay. I think we probably got only one other prominent name. But other than that, you know, it's a bit of a sort of mixture of European actors and.
Yeah, from all over, actually. Like Pontius Pilate, Bulgarian.
Yes, he's fantastic, actually.
Yeah, excellent. I mean, you can, when he speaks Latin, you can, I feel that you can sort of tell that is an Eastern European accent, but it doesn't matter.
You know? I wish we had a Latin language scholar on to tell us, because I did Latin at school and university, but I'm not going to be able to tell you.
I think it's as close to as possible to the street Latin that they spoke. I mean, you do see the great parallels between that and modern Italian and some of the things that they say. I can't speak for the Aramaic, unfortunately, but I do believe that it's what they think, you know, as much research as they've done and what they have as evidence today is as close as possible that they've got to what Jesus spoke at the time. The wonderful extra features on the Blu-ray of the making of the film and the language consultants who work with the actors around the table, and you see them rehearsing and practicing their lines. It's really interesting.
Well, okay, so we've got Maya Morgenstern, who plays Mary.
His mum, she's excellent.
Romanian actress.
She's absolutely brilliant. Perfectly cast as you know, a loving mother. I mean, it's devastating, you know, what she goes through in the film.
It's quite awful, actually. Yeah.
It's a great find. You know, the fact that he didn't go, I'm going to fill this with names.
Exactly. Yeah. Well done, Mel Gibson, for that.
Really, and Monica Bellucci is probably the only other, you know, the famous one.
And Monica Bellucci, I mean, she's incredible. On so many different levels, Tim.
Yeah, on a lot of different levels.
Yeah, I'm a huge, I love Monica Bellucci. She's, for people not familiar, she's been an Italian actress. I don't know if she's still married to him, but she was married to Vincent Cassel, very cool French actor.
Yeah, no, they divorced, I think, in 2013 or something.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they did a horrific film together called Irreversible, which I would strongly suggest people avoid.
Oh,
it's just you know, very well
there's
made.
There's a brutal scene
to the
in
point
that.
Where to the point where I'm not sure it's entirely necessary to put this sort of stuff on screen. Actually,
that's Gaspar Noé, isn't it? He's a bit of a wrong'un, actually, isn't he, Gaspar?
Monica Bellucci is actually currently going out with Tim Burton.
Mm. Well, she was in a Bond film. She's been in lots of stuff. She's absolutely incredible. The Matrix. She's, I think, been a model as well. She's incredible woman.
Yeah, brilliant. Big fan.
She's definitely a friend of aspects of history.
And she's very good in this.
It's
not the biggest role in the world, but she's very good in, you know.
Of Mary Magdalena.
Yes. And potentially Jesus' wife.
Or his lady friend, his special lady friend, and elsewhere. I mean, those are the kind of the Pontius part. You mentioned him, Hristo Namov Shopov, who's the Bulgarian actor who plays Pilate. It's interesting because Pontius Pilate comes over. If you are brought up in certainly you and I, Church of England type upbringing in you know England, we are brought up that Pontius Pilate is the person who condemned him to death, condemned Jesus to death, and so for that reason is in the sort of Western tradition, a negatively portrayed figure. Whereas I don't think that's the case for, and that's not the case in this film. I think in this film, he is portrayed more sympathetically. And Judea was notoriously a quite a volatile province for the Romans to govern. The famous revolt, which would take place 40-odd years later, and it's shown in the film that he has to constantly deal with the competing interests in the province. So I think his portrayal is really quite interesting. I mean, I think this leads us on to the sort of the accusation of anti-Semitism of the high priests of the Jewish high priests, who are presented sort of baying for blood.
Yeah, it's weird because I'm not, even though we, you know, you and I went to the same school, we at that stage we were brought up, you know, in a Christian environment. You know, we had to read the Bible. I kind of never thought the stories were very good, but I never really got into actual belief system. It always struck me as a metaphor pretty much all my life. But when it comes to this and the historical aspects of this, I mean, when I watched the film, I didn't think about it at all. And even though I had read about the controversy over it and that there were accusations of anti-Semitism, particularly in that scene where he's in front, Pontius Pilate's in front of everyone and Jesus is there and they bring out Barabbas, you know, and they're yelling. I kind of, weirdly, I thought I remembered it as this is what happened in the Bible. It never really struck me that, oh, he's leaning a little bit more sympathetically to Pontius Pilate. I mean, ultimately, he condemns him to death. And I was trying to figure out afterwards what would have made Mel Gibson, or rather, what would have made people, audiences, think, oh, it was a little bit less anti-Semitic had Mel Gibson done, for example, had them shout less at Pontius Pilate, had them not really shown that much passion in the way they were yelling. And it made me think, yeah, but wouldn't that happen? Isn't that actually what happened?
I think that there are a couple of scenes where the camera lingers maybe a little too long. High priest looking satisfied that Jesus is going,
which is interesting because the cinematic technique then it informs you that had he not lingered on that shot, then Mel Gibson would be less anti-Semitic than he's being. You know, which is a very, I'm like, well, I don't know. I'm not sure whether a lingering shot enhances anti-Semitism.
That's a good point. Maybe I was looking for it when I was watching.
Because you do go, I think from the controversy, you can't help but go into the film with a preconceived idea that it's, you know, I tried to shed that as much as possible. I'm just going to watch this film, see what, you know, see how it's done, and enjoy, in inverted commas, the experience.
But it made me think that they look like, you know, Life of Brian did very well in costume. And it just looked like Passion of the Christ borrowed a lot of the costumes from Brian. So it was like, well done.
And the legacy of Life of Brian is obviously extremely strong.
Yes, indeed. I mean, you know, it's inevitable you're going to think about Life of Brian throughout this. Should we get on to our categories?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I think first up, let's go with best scene.
Well, for me, it's there is really one, my favorite is, I think, everything about this sequence and scene, the way it's edited, the way it's performed, and the way it's scored, and the way he's directed it, make it, for me, the most powerful scene in the film. And it's not the flogging, even though that's pretty intense and pretty amazing. It's the sequence where his mum runs to him when he's carrying the cross, and it's intercut with flashbacks of him as a child tripping in their garden, and she runs, arms outstretched, to him. And it's I mean, I watched it in the cinema twice, and I've never, in both times, I've never heard people sob more and harder than in that scene, in any film I've ever seen. There were these intakes of breath that were gurgled. It was a really bizarre experience, because and it made me think that film's done its job actually for a lot of people. I mean, there was this, these people, men, they couldn't really, I don't, it was almost like they couldn't take it.
Well, it is very powerful, but I mean, I was watching that again, and mm-hmm. the boy, the flashback is when mm-hmm. the boy's about 3 years old or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He just tripped over. Didn't need that response from his mother. I think she was being a bit mollycoddling there.
Maybe, but you aren't a mother.
No, that's true. I'm definitely not a mother. But it's not like, you know, he was tripping over onto a busy road with a car.
But I think Mel Gibson was making a point that, you know, ultimately this is somebody's son. You know, Jesus was a mother's son.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And to for her to see that what was happening and to be powerless, that all she could do was just run towards him,
well,
and help try to pick him up. Yeah,
I think for a similar reason, then the scene for me is the flogging,
because it's just so darn entertaining.
I wouldn't say it's entertaining, but it is so powerful and profound. You have the appearance of his mother and mm-hmm. Mary Magdalena and his brother, and
when she crouches down and says why,
and the devil now. Yeah, and the Roman soldiers sort of jeering, and you get the appearance of Abinader, who I think is based on Sisyphus, the Roman soldier who provided the help at the end in the crucifixion. And the, you know, the agony, the act's just sort of torture, basically, is what it is. So summing up what Mel Gibson was going for in that Jesus suffered so that we wouldn't have to.
I don't really see how he could have done it and sort of softened it, because the point is, if it hadn't been horrifically brutal, which I'm sure it was, it probably was even worse. Let's be honest. They probably did, you know, want to think about.
That was pretty bad.
That's pretty bad. But it had it been diluted, then the idea of suffering and you know, what is called the passion, it wouldn't really have, I think, have hit home as much. And you know, we'd think, well, you know, he suffered a bit, but it wasn't. But the point of and this takes me back to the point I was making about this guy being of humble beginnings, selfless, and being, you know, I mean, to go through something like that with the belief that I'm doing this for other people, to have suffered so greatly makes the act so incredibly magnanimous. You know, you need to see it horrifically as it possibly was.
Was it criticized, this scene?
I think so. I think that people, you know, were like, just sick. It didn't have to be that. And it was like, well, then you won't, then it's, I don't know. It
but then
work,
you may as well criticize Jaws for Robert Shaw being eaten.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Spielberg could have made that a lot more horrific. But the point, it's not the point of the film. That you know, Jaws is the fact that Robert Shaw is eaten by the thing that he so doesn't fear. We don't have to see it in a horrific manner. It's just like, oh, damn.
It is quite horrific.
It's horrific, but you know, he could have bitten him in half and seen him. Yeah, all sorts of things. But the point is, we need to see the suffering in this. Yeah, because if we don't see the suffering, then it's not going to make much sense.
I agree. And that's why I found it the most powerful, the best scene in the film for me. I liked Pontius Pilate dealing with the crowd. He obviously knew that if he didn't bend to the demands of the high priests, he then has to deal with the reaction of the followers of Jesus. So it's interesting that. And
yeah, I mean, it just sort of escalates in terms of the intensity, because then he's carrying the cross, you know, which and the Roman soldiers are being very nasty and jeering him. And then when it gets to the actual scene of the crucifixion where they nail him, I mean, the nailing is pretty insane. But again, I think it all adds to the fact that look what this guy went through.
Yes. So if we were to settle on a scene, then
I mean, the most powerful scene. Yeah. Okay. The flogging is. I'm going for the truly emotional, as opposed to intensely.
It was very moving when his mom comes over and he says, "I will make the world anew."
Yeah, I make everything new.
I make everything new.
And then he just sort of touches her cheek and stands up and carries on.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't be able to do that.
Great
okay,
work.
Well, we could go with the flogging because the flogging is quite iconic.
I think so, because I just think that the flashback...
is not a big
trip,
big deal.
It's not... I think she overreacted over a little... The little boy fell over and he
the
was
first
getting
time
back up before she got to it.
It's the first time I've ever heard this heartless approach to this to a mother running to her child, but fine.
Well, you know, yeah, maybe it speaks to my own upbringing, but let we'll move on to the we now get to the best performance. It's difficult to go beyond. I mean, he's in the camera's on him for much of the
and he went through hell. He was struck by lightning when he was on the cross, which is a nice little bit of trivia.
Well, I think that was the least. Was he in reality?
In reality,
no.
Yeah. So you know,
I
adds
think that
to
might have caused Caviezel to have certain. Was he already
issues? That as soon as that happened, he went. I'm following QAnon. I don't know, but he was under, you know, and he was on antibiotics, and he had temperature fevers when he was on the acting. The prosthetics, and he was freezing on the cross. It was so cold, apparently. But he is, you know, he's the suffering. He is portrayed quite convincingly without being overly dramatic. You know, when he's like, when they put the crown on his head, he doesn't sort of go into the shenanigans of screaming and shouting. It's kind of like a subdued agony that he does very well. I think he's very good. I think his mother is very good. I think she's in for a shout.
Okay, well, we also have another category of best supporting.
So. Oh, yes, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
But his mother is very good. So I don't know. I'm going to let you choose who's the best performance because...
I mean, I would go with him probably for the lead and her for the best supporting.
I think we have to go with... He is the kind of... He's got the light, nice... He's a handsome man. He's good cheekbones. Are there going to be questions about casting a white American male?
Who happens to share the same initials as the Lord.
Indeed. I'm just anticipating criticism of the sequel, but we'll see.
Yeah, yeah. And the fact that it's 20 years after the making of this.
Yeah, I mean, because I think actually, you know, you can go down a complete... rabbit hole in the whole casting controversy and
you could I mean it's what doesn't matter
what's his name. I know it's acting so that's my view, but
I think the Roman soldiers are amazing
they're excellent I was watching it thinking, you know, obviously people are going to complain, oh, you're presenting the Roman, but Italians might get upset,
the Romans were bastards.
But
they're behaving
like squaddies from the ancient world. So.
Yeah, it's true. But the you know, that's one of the things that kind of I would also point out, you know, about this whole anti-Semitic approach with Pontius Pilate doing this, and then the people in the crowd shouting and screaming. You know, the Romans were not exactly nice people.
No, you don't get an empire from wokery.
No, and you know they crucified him ultimately. So you know that you know they're not mentioned.
Okay, so we'll go with move on to most inaccurate scene
according to.
Well, that's this is a big challenge. This is a controversial section.
Mm.
You know, this is based off four different gospels.
Yeah.
Intermingling each, it's very difficult because.
What about Satan screaming from his lair as soon as Jesus dies?
Yes.
I want to say her lair, because Satan was actually played by a woman.
Yeah, but I like little details, like there were maggots crawling out of his nose early on, weren't there? You know, the inference, you know, flies.
Yes. Is that, and the snake that comes from under his cloak?
Yes.
That Jesus stamps on. Which I was like, excuse me, that's animal cruelty.
I think
you
that
can't
was,
do that.
That's from the, I think that's a bit of from the Old Testament.
Yes.
Intruding into the, it was just interesting. But I don't think Mel Gibson ever said this is a historically accurate film.
No, I think he just did it. Well, it's mainly from the gospel. Actually, which
well,
gospel
exactly.
Was it?
But I'm very much happy for you to go with, because I think that did attract some criticism. You know, there's a baby being carried by Satan. So maybe sort of the involvement of Satan is a bit inaccurate.
Yeah. If we're talking actual, literal, historical events, maybe. When Jesus goes to... Okay, I've got one. How about this? When Jesus goes... When he's been flogged, after he's been flogged, and he returns to Pontius Pilate... And he goes into Pontius Pilate's house.
Yes.
He doesn't indicate this in the subtitles, but Pontius Pilate can speak Aramaic, and he's talking Aramaic to Jesus. And he asks him a question, and Jesus responds in Latin. Now, it doesn't say in subtitles, under Jesus's subtitles, brackets, in Latin, or speaking Latin. But he just responds in Latin. And Pontius Pilate gives him a quick, surprised look, and then carries on. Now, was Jesus fluent in Latin?
I don't know if there's any evidence. I don't know.
Because he is in this film. So historians who are listening, write in to Ollie and either correct this or confirm that, yes, he did. I don't know if Joshua would have studied Latin as a carpenter's son. Maybe that was the done thing, but I don't think he did.
I don't think there's any kind of evidence that he did, but I should imagine he knew a little bit.
But I mean, he converses quite well in this one, so I would say that's potentially up there with an inaccurate.
But he then
historically inaccurate.
But he gave sight, according to the New Testament, he gave sight to blind people. So I think speaking Latin would be a doddle.
That's true. In fact, he's probably multilingual. He probably speaks every language in the world, including any Native American language that hadn't even been discovered. But he should technically be able to speak them.
Maybe.
See where I'm going with this.
Yeah. Okay. So right. We'll go with the devil and the weird looking baby as well. Any kind of devil involvement?
Right. Sure.
The devil's Kaiser Soze. Anyway, we'll move on to the best supporting performance.
Which, I think it would go to Maya.
Well, I was wanting to go with Pontius Pilate, played by the Bulgarian actor.
Mm-hmm.
Forgotten his name now.
To add to the controversy of the anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to him.
So he's probably doing very well in Bulgaria.
Really interesting character. I think he was prefect of Judea for about 10 years. And this is under the reign of the emperor Tiberius. You know, it's a difficult posting. I mean, he obviously explains how much he doesn't like the posting at all. He thinks it's a complete backwater. I mean, you're having, you know, as I mentioned before, dealing with these Judea, a very volatile region, as I mentioned. But he then, I think, returns in about 36 AD to Rome. I think he's recalled. And then we don't know anything more about him after that. But in sort of then Christian tradition, he converts to Christianity, of course, which, right. You know, there's no historical evidence that he did.
Oh, okay.
But in some of the Christian tradition, he did convert to Christianity, and his wife showed, I mean, there's not much known about it. We don't even know the wife's name, but in the film, she's shown as very sympathetic. I found the Pontius Pilate side of things very interesting, and I thought the actor was really, really good in it.
Yeah, he was excellent. Just thought Maya's very, very good indeed.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll go with Maya because, but a real shout out to Hristo Naumov Shopov.
So, Simon Baker Award quickly with Jim Caviezel.
Yeah, Simon Baker Award for Jim Caviezel, the Abraham Zapruder Award to the flogging, the Gary Oldman Award for supporting goes to Maya.
Morgan Stern.
Yes. And the Argo Award for inaccurate scene is the devil. And then finally, legacy rating. So I think it had a major impact, didn't it?
Yeah, for its subject matter, but not only that, the fact that it, well, all the controversy that it surrounded it, but also the financial success of it was huge. So I think when it comes to, you know, if someone says film about Jesus, you know, it comes quite top of the list, I would say.
Yeah. I remember speaking to someone at work, having watched the film, and actually I seem to remember I worked in technology, and we were all, I think we might have been sharing an illegal DVD.
Okay, you just said that on live air, but okay.
And everyone had watched it. And I remember talking about the flogging scene and how awful it was. And the person I spoke to was clearly religious. And they said, yes, this is what he did. You know, he was moved by it very, very much so. And I think that the temptation for many people like you and I are, you know, secular and I think we're all very, you know, evidence-based and everything. But I think a film like that has been very powerful to many people. So
yeah, absolutely. And I thought it was, you know, it's a great. I mean, I think it's a great addition to the canon of visceral cinema.
Cinema.
Just on in that to describe it like that. You can't deny that it's, you know, whether you like it or not. It's, you know, I understand that people are just like, oh, I didn't like it at all. Completely understand.
Well, let's see how the resurrection.
Yeah.
It goes down next year because this I would give this a good 3.5 out of 5 legacy rating.
Yeah, I would agree.
Great stuff. All right, Tim.
Thank you very much.
This has been fab.
I'd really like to. It'd be interesting to actually carry on the discussion of the historical figure of. Yeah. But it'd be interesting to hear. Do you get a lot of comments from your listeners and see what they?
Often. Often. So we'll see. We'll see what they think about this. As ever, please get in touch. History@aspectsofhistory.com or there's through the Dredge social media. Both of us are on there. Links are in the show notes. But that's been fantastic. That's your film club. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks so much. See you next time.
Thanks so much for listening. Plenty more great history to come, including the first Brit in Japan and Iran and Britain. But until then, thank you and good night.